This is Matt from PureNintendo.com, and you are listening to the KoopaCast, PureNintendo.com's official podcast. Before we begin, I would like to thank Big Giant Circles for allowing us to use his music for our podcast. To hear more of his work, please check out iTunes.com/BigGiantCircles, or you can go to BigGiantCircles.com. Everyone, welcome to the KoopaCast. I am your host, Matt, the Multimedia Manager of PNM and PureNintendo.com, your independent source for all things Nintendo. And before I get into who is joining me today, you may have noticed that something's a little bit different. Yes, the KoopaCast is now audio only. Anyway, I am joined here by Alex Schramke.
How's it going, everybody?
Justin Sharp.
Hey, everyone.
And Trevor Gould.
Hi, guys. Thanks for tuning in and listening.
All right. And it's been kind of a busy week for everyone in the game journalist world. A certain event has taken place in L.A. once again. This is E3 2016. So we are sitting around the microphone today to talk to you and share our thoughts about how Nintendo performs this E3 2016 and kind of talk about what games we're excited for. And I'm going to start with that. Before I start with that, Zelda's off the table. You can't say Zelda was your favorite game because it's a foregone conclusion. I need another game that you're excited about that you saw. All right? We're going to start
with... You should have told us this before we started.
Yeah. I had no time to prepare.
Yeah. That just tells me that you guys were not excited about any game whatsoever except for Zelda.
No, that's not true.
When it comes to Zelda.
I don't know. I mean, you guys heard it here. Audience, I want you to decide. Let us know on Twitter. Was everybody excited? Did you buy that? Because I sure didn't.
All right. I'll start off. There were some nice surprises. I think the new Mario Party for 3DS looked intriguing with, it kind of eliminated one of the frustrations that old entries had where you had to sit through everybody else's turn. So I think that's got some potential. I thought the new IP there, Ever Oasis, looked really good. I have to learn more about the story before I know if I'm sold on it, but I think that was a nice surprise, too. I'll go with those two.
All right. I was surprisingly intrigued about Mario Party Star Rush as well, because they said no more waiting for your turn. You know, everyone's going to take the turn at once, which is, I think, a great step forward for that series because, I mean, those games last a long time. And, I mean, God help the person who chose 50, like, who is in that group of your friends who are like, hey, let's do 50 turns.
Well, especially for a handheld Mario Party, I mean, I can remember sitting around, like, the GameCube versions and not minding necessarily spending a big chunk of time because you're at home on the couch. But, you know, for a handheld, if you're playing on a commute or something or, you know, in between errands, whatever, it's good to have a setup like that.
I want that for the Wii U Mario Party. I want that for every Mario Party in the future.
Well, maybe this one.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say I kind of like in the game mode that they showed. I believe it was called Toad Scramble. They kind of ditched the game board, and it was more of just an environment that you moved around in. So it kind of made the path that you took with the role that you got a little more meaningful. I think you could strategize much more.
Mm-hmm. I think the only thing I was a little bit disappointed about was that when we got the press release and it says, no more waiting for your turn, I was expecting like this free-for-all where like everybody's like rolling the dice as fast as they can just to like get through the map. And of course, like, now if you think about it, that doesn't make sense because everybody has to go through their turn, and then you do a mini game, and then, you know, rinse and repeat. But I just wanted to see that chaos. So, like that chaos is like what, like, that's how we played, like, Monopoly. As like when I got older, because we were like, you know, forget this 3-hour nonsense. All right, just roll the dice. All right, you want to buy? Okay, let that guy's rolling the dice. Hurry up, buy, sell, buy, sell. Like, our turns lasted like 5 seconds, and it was just chaos, and you had to think on your feet.
I can imagine them doing test audiences with that technique and having a bunch of, like, smashed 3DSs or...
And then the other game you mentioned was that Ever Oasis for the 3DS.
That was cool just because it was totally... like, we didn't even catch wind, I think, that there was going to be a new IP till like, the day before.
Yeah, that's when... It was a very recent... Mm-hmm. I remember it was like during E3, I think, that we knew that this game was
going to be announced. And it looks sizable. I mean, I was thinking maybe some little eShop-type game or something, just to... That might be put up right away, but this looks like it's a meaty experience.
Yeah, and it's got a bit of a pedigree behind it, too, because it's Grazo... LTD, which is the people behind Majora's Mask 3D. And then the producer-director is Koichi Ishii, who was the guy who's, like, you know, behind Final Fantasy 1 through 3 and the Mana series. And, like, he kind of had a hand in, like, you know, designing some of those iconic characters. Like the Chocobos and the Moogles. So, it really, you know, they really put their weight behind, like, this new IP RPG, like, this action RPG. And I think it looks pretty fun. It looks like there's like a bit of a dungeon crawl.
I love the visuals to it.
Yeah, like that.
Yeah, I think it had a real nice look for it. And I guess it's to be expected at this point in the 3DS life. You know, people are really have kind of maxed out, you know, the hardware for all it's worth. So most of the games we're getting, you know, should be pretty good looking.
See, I don't feel like they've maxed out the hardware for what it's worth because the hardware is the new 3DS. And this one's not a new 3DS exclusive. Like, there doesn't seem to be, or at least as far as I know, maybe you guys saw more than I did. I'm sure you guys saw more than I did. But, you know, it didn't look like it was, like, there was any distinct advantage for having a new 3DS versus just a 3DS for this new one.
Yeah, and I think that's to be expected. When Xenoblade was a new 3DS exclusive, I think it's going to be more the exception than... I think most developers are going for that broader audience. There's 60 million now for ESs, so it makes more sense to kind of target that. Otherwise, you get into territory where maybe a million of the new 3DSs are out there, maybe a little bit more.
I mean, which isn't to say there isn't new 3DS games. I mean, the new Runbow Pocket is new 3DS, and that might be more to do with the maybe less the visuals and more just the multiplayer nature with having 9 people, you know, potentially on screen. I'm not sure how that exactly is gonna work, but
there's actually some virtual console games that are new 3DS exclusive. Obviously, the Super Nintendo ones are the higher profile ones, but I noticed actually today Nintendo released a new 3DS exclusive in Mega Man 7 on the 3DS.
Yeah, and I believe that's also released on the Wii U. And I got to go and get on that. After my review game, I'll go get on that. Yes, I've got 1 through 6 thanks to the Legacy Collection, which is still awesome. But yeah, Oasis
is underappreciated, though, I think.
7? I have not touched 7 yet, so. I think 8's everybody's unappreciated classic.
Which is funny, because I think I played the most out of that one.
Really? You played the most out of 8?
Yeah, I'm kind of an oddball when it comes to Mega Man. I'm not very good at those games, but I still like to try and pretend like I am.
For some reason, that's kind of how I am.
Yeah, 8 was just... perfect for me. I don't know. That's one I actually got to Wily's Castle on. I know that's pathetic, but I'm just that bad of a Mega Man player.
I'm just impressed you got through all the cutscenes.
I think 7, too. Didn't 7 come out after X? I think that put it at a bit of, maybe of a disadvantage, because it seemed like, in certain ways, maybe it was a step backwards to, like, the old NES games.
Yeah, I want to say 7 did come after X.
Yeah, I think it was a victim of timing more than the game itself, because I think the game was just a natural step up from the NES classics.
And go ahead and getting back on topic, we talked about Ever Oasis here. And to me, it kind of looks like it's got like this action RPG, but kind of mixed like with this Zelda dungeon crawling, because like dungeon crawling and puzzle solving seem to be pretty big factors into this. At least that's what I saw from the Nintendo Treehouse highlights.
Yeah.
Go for it, Trevor.
I was going to say, it looks like the 3DS is really going to have a lot of potentially time-consuming games with, like, Ever Oasis, the Dragon Quest games, Yo-Kai Watch, not to mention, you know, the RPG-type games that have already come out for it, like Bravely Default, that Paper Mario one earlier in the year. So I guess, you know, at a certain point, something's going to give, you know. Not everybody's going to want to sink in time to all these games. It makes me feel a little bad for Wii U owners that they can't get, you know, one of these 3DS games on the Wii U. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah, the 3DS really has just established itself as like this, you know, go-to console for RPGs and, like, you know, yeah, basically just especially like JRPGs, I should say. 3DS really seems to be like that central hub, it's continuing to go strong into 2016 and again into 2017.
Yeah. Well, it's a numbers game too.
What was that, Alex? Yo, Alex.
You mean on Alex or me?
Alex.
Yeah, I'm here. There's problems.
That's okay. We'll cut all that out. So what were you saying before, Alex?
I think we met a lot.
What I was saying?
Yeah, what were you saying?
Oh, sorry, guys. It's cutting out really bad. What I was saying is when it comes to Nintendo handhelds, they're pretty much king.
Okay.
That's all I was going to say.
Okay. Trevor, what were you saying?
Like Justin was saying, too, it's a numbers game. If the 3DS has almost 60 million, it's going to get more resources than, you know, the Wii U, which is what, like 14 million or something? And with NX coming right around the corner, it's understandable why, you know, one system's getting seemingly bigger games and the other one not so much.
Yeah, the other one does seem to be winding down a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to do Pokemon and Dragon Quest VII. That's all right with Justin.
Yeah.
All right. What do you want to start with?
Let's start with Pokemon, I guess.
Are you talking about Pokemon Sun and Moon now, or are you talking about Pokemon Go?
Pokemon Sun and Moon.
All right.
That's what I was most excited for.
Yeah. We got to look at 3 new Pokemon.
Let me bring them up, actually, because I don't know their names.
Grubbish. Okay, this is my head. Okay, one's not Grubbish. It's like Grubble, I think. It's like the little beetle larva thingy.
Give me like 2 seconds, so...
No, I'm trying to guess. This is good entertainment. Tiki Takaw, which is like the bird thingy.
I think it's Picky Peck.
Picky Peck, that's right. And then...
Young Goose.
Yeah, that's right, the mongoose thingy. The ferret mongoose thing, yeah, young goose. It's like Yangoos. For some reason, I don't know how to spell that.
I'm looking at him right now. I'm on CeraVe, so.
Oh, okay. You should look at purenintendo.com because I put all the pictures up.
True. I don't know. When it comes to Pokemon, I always go to CeraVe.
We need to change that. Justin, can we have like a Pokemon Wikipedia section on our website?
Sure, yeah.
All right. Alex, you're in charge of it.
Oh, thanks.
And as punishment for not going on the site, you have to change your avatar to the least popular Pokemon there is. for like a month.
I think that's like Chikorita or something. Japan really hates Chikorita.
Well, that's your new nickname, Chikorita.
Which one's Chikorita? That's the leaf one, right? The leaf Pokemon from Gold and Silver?
From Gold and Silver.
Really? That was like my favorite starter.
I think Japan voted that as the least popular starter out of all of them.
Really? Yeah. Even after that seal?
Even after that.
So the seal's name is Popplio. I just looked that up. The seal's name is Popplio. Because that one got a lot of flack around Twitter when they announced the starters for the Sun and Moon.
Yeah, so much so they started a Popplio Defense Force. That's what people were calling themselves. They were trying to defend him, which I thought was hilarious. They made a logo and everything.
I'd like to throw out, and this might be a bit of a spoiler, depending on when you're listening to this, but in our Pokemon poll, which is coming up in the next issue of PNM, Popplio was our last place finisher with only 21% of the vote, compared to 40 for Litten and 39 for Rowlett.
Yes.
So they were neck and neck, but Popplio was never a contender.
Team Litten. That's the one I'm picking.
All right.
What about you guys? What are you picking?
I don't know.
I think I'm going to go with Rowlett.
I'm picking Pokemon Go.
I'm also picking Pokemon Go.
I gotta say, I'm not the biggest Pokemon fan, but it was amusing because we watched. It started with the Zelda trailer, and we were all like awestruck.
Yeah.
And then there was like 45 minutes of Pokemon. And I remember James was. We were talking on Slack, and he's like, "Man, now I wish they'd go back to Zelda." It was sort of like a kind of anticlimactic in a way.
It was. Well, yeah, it did kind of take the wind out of their sails a little bit because they're just like, oh, let's show some gameplay. It was just such a slow pace, and you're like, okay, when are we getting back to Zelda?
I think I was the only one excited for Pokemon. I was like, oh, this is great. Nice little warm-up before Zelda.
Yeah, well, I'm super excited about Sun and Moon as well, but even with that said, I was like, this looks cool, but let's get back to Zelda.
It's hard. In the Treehouse defense, I imagine it's hard to be doing gameplay and translation at the same time with a stage full of people, but
yeah
it was a little
You know, it's funny, too, what little I've been messing around with learning Japanese words and stuff. The word ano in Japan is basically their version of or. And so, for some reason, like, ano, every time they say that, like, it just sticks out in my mind. It's like, if I hear ano one more time.
Little word whisker.
And that's why you're our official translator when we go to E3 next year.
Yeah, and you'll find that they say it a lot.
Yeah.
But going back to Pokemon Sun and Moon here, because we seem to have gotten off track yet again. I know you guys.
We can edit that part out. Nobody will have to know we got off track.
I know you guys are excited about Zelda, but we got to wait to talk about Zelda because we got to talk about the other games there because they were there. We got to give everybody their fair shake here.
Indeed.
But
how about that Dragon Quest VII?
What's that?
How about that Dragon Quest VII?
Well, we haven't even talked about the Battle Royale yet in Pokemon Sun and Moon that they just revealed.
Okay, let's do that then. I'm just here to derail you.
Okay. So yeah, one of the newest battle features for Pokemon is going to be that four-player battle royale. It was definitely an interesting mechanic. I thought it was going to be a last man standing sort of thing until I kind of read up a little bit more on the PR that they sent out. And it's going to be the first guy who goes down, that signifies the end of the battle. And then everybody else is kind of scored on how many they killed. Or I'm sorry, KO'd. Excuse me. They were knocked out.
Fainted.
You know.
Come on.
No, they never kill them.
and how many of their Pokemon are left standing?
I'm not too sure I'm excited about that. I don't know. Mm. It seems like there's... It's
probably depends on the group you're with. Yeah. Or whatever.
It seems
like... That's the local multiplayer one, is it?
Yeah. It seems like it's like a very interesting twist on, you know, what has been a very traditional formula, I guess, for the Pokemon series. You know, the one-on-ones. You know, even though they changed it up where it's going to be like your two Pokemon versus their two Pokemon, you know, stuff like that. You know, this is the first time they, like, put four people in at once, more of, like, a Rumble kind of setting. And, I mean, it's definitely interesting from, like, a gameplay perspective, but for some reason, I think it'd be interesting to see, like, say, at the next, like, Pokemon World Championships that they hold, to watch, like, four of these, like, you know, top players kind of see how they strategize when they go one-on-one, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
But yes, enough about Pokemon Sun and Moon. We can move on to Dragon Quest VII, Fragments of Forgotten Past, right? I believe that's the subtitle.
Correct, Mundo.
All right, and this is definitely another one of the ones that I have yet to have like too much time to look at. So I'm going to definitely rely on you guys to kind of carry the conversation on this one a little bit more.
Fair enough. I think what initially impressed me about it is how nice the game works and all the time and effort they've put into not only the visuals, but just translating the sheer amount of text. And I don't imagine on the live stream that they said just the sheer amount of text in the game is one of the reasons they didn't want to localize it. There was just so much like party talk dialogue and things of that nature. And what convinced them ultimately to localize it was fans from France and other regions writing into Nintendo and even doing like a petition saying, please localize this. And they finally listened. So I thought that was really cool.
Wow, so that's like an Operation Rainfall Part 2 kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought it interesting. I'm not overly familiar with the Dragon Quest series, but how they, and I think Alex might have actually tweeted it. I don't remember the exact quote, but how they really view it as like an accessible game, you know, kind of for a broad audience, and which is never how I thought of it. I always thought of like, you know, old school Dragon Warrior, like for the NES is like a hardcore game. But it seems like it's going to be, at least to initially get going, it shouldn't be overly complex. And I wish I could remember the quote. Do you remember it, Alex? Or
they said that they wanted to make a game that gamers young and old can pick up and enjoy from start to finish.
Yeah, there you go.
And I had your same thoughts, too, because I was like, wait a minute. Like, Dragon Quest games are notoriously difficult, so I wonder how they're going to appease fans and try to get new people into it as well. Because they are notoriously hard games.
I mean, maybe this game is just like, they're trying to use it as like a, for a lot of people, for like a stepping point, I guess, or a springboard to maybe get into Dragon Quest games in the further. Like, oh, okay, I figured this game out. Maybe it's time to go back and take a look at the rest of the series.
Well, they did mention that you don't have to have any prior experience with the series to get into this, even though they're still using the same pretty much core characters they've always used, which I thought was interesting. But it sounds like this could be a good debut where you're not going to lose a whole lot of like backstory or whatnot.
I got to say, just as a quick aside, I like the way you said that. When you talk about experience, it makes me think that, like, when you start up Dragon Quest, it's going to ask for, like, your RPG resume. Like, sorry, sir, we're looking for somebody with a Bachelor's of Science in JRPGs. What? You only have 2 years of part-time RPG experience? I'm sorry, sir. We'll have to go with another one.
I wonder, too, I mean, I don't know how it works with RPGs. You normally see it in other genres, but it could just be something as simple as having, like, the difficulty levels or, you know, maybe having the battles be, like, on auto or, you know. I know there is going to be some type of setup where if you step away from the game for a while, there'll be reminders of what you were trying to accomplish so you can get right back into it, because I know that's been an issue with me with like RPG type games. You put it down for a month and then you forget where you're going. So they're addressing that where that's not going to, you know, hinder people.
Yeah, I was glad to hear that too, because I'm the same way. I'll get distracted and I'll try to come back and be like, what the heck am I doing again? Where am I supposed to go?
Yeah. No, I think everybody's a little bit the same way. I recently started, I'm not afraid to say it. I recently came into an Xbox 360 and then another Xbox 360.
Wait, what? You got two?
I have two. One's a loaner.
So an Xbox 720.
Yes, I got, it actually equals a single Xbox 1.5. And I was starting off with Blue Dragon, because that's one of the games that came with the deal that I got.
Oh, yeah.
And I got a little bit into it, and then I just, like, realized that I had a review game title coming up, and I just stopped, like, a couple days prior. I was like, if I keep going, then we're going to start getting more into the story, and I'm going to get completely lost when I come back to this in, like, 3 or 4 weeks or something. So it was like, I just stopped right there and picked up Xenoblade Chronicles X, and, like, I don't need to know what's going on here. And just, you know, zoned out and played until the review game came.
That game's on DS, too. Not the Blue Dragon, but there's an offshoot or whatever.
Oh, is there? Okay. I didn't know that. I just remember the
name escapes me right now, but...
Those are games I've seen that I've been curious to try, but have never made the jump.
Yeah, it's got that... early voice acting bug still into it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can look past that, then you'll find just like, you know, it's a sign of the times. Luckily, the cutscenes just don't go for very long. Everything kind of moves at a nice pace. And derailed again. Awesome.
Yeah. Right. Just for the record, it looks like there's two DS Blue Dragon games. Blue Dragon Plus and Blue Dragon Awakened Shadow. So I don't really know much about them. I just remembered that there was at least one.
Okay. Anybody got anything else to say about Dragon Quest VII before we move on?
Just that awesome Akira Toriyama art. Love it.
For the sake of the... Oh, I'm sorry, Alex. I didn't realize you were still going.
No, I was just saying that awesome Akira Toriyama art for Dragon Quest VII is awesome.
For the sake of 3DS sales in America, I hope it can have a measure of the success that the games have had in Japan. Is they sell like hotcakes there, and they never seem to match how they do in Japan.
That's very true. So, Justin, you're kind of last in this panel, aside from me, I guess. What games were you excited about?
Well, other than Zelda and other than Pokemon, I would say I'm looking forward to, And some people would be like, Paper Mario, come on, this. But I am still intrigued about Paper Mario Color Splash. If for nothing else, the art style, I mean, having a Paper Mario in HD now is very exciting to me. I know that some of the combat mechanics look like they're taking after Sticker Star, and not necessarily some of the classic Paper Mario combat that fans have been wanting, but... I'm still curious about it. Like I said, I really like the art style. And it seems to be kind of the last big Wii U game, at least until Zelda comes out. So I think that would probably be one of the last Wii U games I end up picking up. So.
Did they show any gameplay in the Treehouse?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they focused. It was about maybe a 30 or 40 minute.
Right.
There's some cool things that are cutting out.
Hold on, Justin, you're breaking up.
Oh, okay.
All right. Try that again.
Am I better now? Can you hear me, Justin?
Yeah. You're solid.
Cool. One of the cool elements that they had in it was the ability to cut out parts of the background, and they were saying that you use the stylus or use your finger on the touchscreen to kind of draw along these dotted lines on the background, and then Paper Mario could actually go into those cutout areas, and there'd be some platforming and some different secrets that you could find. So it looks like it's going to have some fun, unique gameplay elements to it.
Right. I know this is going to sound like
a really cool detail. I thought was neat was when they were fighting the boss. There was Morton Koopa there, so we have the Koopalings in that one. Yeah. And as you were fighting the boss and doing damage, the color would slowly drain from his sprite, which I thought was really, really cool.
Thanks. Yeah, there were a lot of really fun details that I noticed in that battle. It was pretty cool. I don't know. It's just fun seeing more of it, and it looks like it's coming together, and it's getting to a point where of being really polished. So hopefully it ends up being a good game.
Yeah, kind of give the give the critics something to look at, you know, so you know, maybe people can take back, you know, because the initial reaction to Paper Mario Color Splash was very negative, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it wasn't quite Metroid Federation Force levels, but definitely when they showed it off, they were more people found common. Commonalities with it and Sticker Star, which people widely did not like. So,
and you know what I find interesting, because if you look at Sticker Star, critically and sales wise, it's not like it's got bad reviews, bad sale numbers. I mean, they may not be, you know, as great as some of the prior ones, but they're certainly not bad. But I think most of people's frustrations was, I want Paper Mario 64. I want Thousand Year Door. Yeah. This isn't what I want, so I'm going to dismiss it outright. And I mean, we've seen similar with a lot of franchise, games, you know, like Yoshi and other ones where people have their favorites and they just want a continuation of that while saying they also want something innovative. So, you know, it's sort of a conundrum for Nintendo. What do you do? But that's the sense I got that with Paper Sticker Star and to an extent Color Splash, it's not the traditional RPG experience they want. It's more of that like action RPG hybrid or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and it was interesting. They were interviewed at E3 about Color Splash and some of the gameplay differences from past Mario Paper Mario game. And they basically were saying, well, this is kind of the direction we're going with Paper Mario. If you want that other style, the Mario and Luigi games. So, it's kind of like, hey, fans, sorry, we're kind of going in this direction with Paper Mario. If you want that gameplay from past Paper Mario games, you know, go with the Mario and Luigi series, which, you know, I can see that to a certain extent. They're kind of similar genres. But I don't know. To me, I think they can still stand on their own, even with similar gameplay. So I hope that they eventually circle back around to it, but we'll see.
It is worth mentioning, as of the time we're recording, there's the E3 sale going on. I think the original Paper Mario was only like $1.80, which is an insanely good deal if you haven't played that game.
Yeah, and you get the 10%. Is that with the 10% discount from the My Nintendo?
I think it might be, because when I log on, I see my avatar in the corner. But either way, I mean, you know, $2 or less is crazy good deal.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine if they did Thousand Year Door or they remastered that? I mean, even $40 would still be well worth it. People would be eating that up.
Oh, absolutely. That was an interesting comment, though. It made me think, because I haven't actually played it yet, but the last Mario and Luigi with Paper Mario, the combo that I think came out in January.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was sort of a transitional game where they're like, all right, here Paper Mario is meshing into the Mario and Luigi universe. I wonder if they knew that at the time when they were making it, that was kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. And speaking of Paper Jam and the eShop sale, it's actually one of the games that's on sale, and I think with the discount it's like $22, which is a pretty sizable discount since it only came out 5 months ago or something.
Yeah, I think it came out in January for what, $40?
Yeah, so
it's almost half off.
Yeah, so already being discounted almost 50%, that's pretty big for, you know, Nintendo isn't known for doing, you know, big discounts like that, especially that close to the game's launch. So I hope it's doing well. I don't know if that's an indication of it not doing well, but.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I think we'll go ahead and wrap up, your three's thing. I couldn't really tell you what game I was, like, really excited for that was revealed at E3. I'm definitely interested in Even Oasis. But mostly it's, like, a lot of the games that I saw on there, besides Zelda, are games that I'm interested in, where, like, games that were already announced. So, like, Axiom Verge, which is being ported over to the Wii U. Severed, which is also, which was a Vita game, a Vita exclusive, I believe.
I think it's on iOS as well. It was physically the touch interface. So.
Yeah, and it was lauded as one of the better Vita games out there. And plus, for me, it's also done by Drinkbox Studios, which are the same people behind Guacamelee, which is one of my personal favorites and is a game that I like to fight for as Game of the Year every year.
Yeah, it was a fantastic game. Another one that was cool was Shantae, Half Genie Hero. The new gameplay they showed off at E3 was really fun. Some of the big boss battles.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to Shantae and also Runbo for being games that, you know, are going into that physical realm, because certainly Runbo up till now has been digital, and Shantae, Half Genie, you know, for the longest time we thought was going to be a digital game, but it's really great to see these indie games, you know, join like Shovel Knight and other ones and get copies on the shelf, because that's only going to increase their audience.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. And I think we're out of time, and we're going to wrap up this KoopaCast right here. There were no other big games, I don't think, so let's go ahead and end it here. Wow. None of you guys tried to stop me for that, huh?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at a list. I don't know if you just want to give it a shout-out. We don't have to necessarily go into depth, but
shout-outs to Ace Attorney.
It got more attention for PlayStation because of Crash Bandicoot, but there is a new Skylanders that's coming out for Wii U. Skylanders Imaginators.
Yeah. I think Matt was alluding to the fact he was going to close out the KoopaCast without talking about Zelda.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
You're driving, man.
Which is ridiculous. Obviously, so we finally got, after, 2 years, I believe, of waiting, we finally got some footage. We don't have new footage. We have some footage of The Legend of Zelda, which is now named Breath of the Wild. And that's going to be coming out for the Wii U and NX simultaneously in 2017, March 2017, I believe.
Yeah. They were careful to say E3, though. They just said 2017. They didn't say March, which is
kind of backpedaled on that a bit, I think.
Yeah, I do think they're probably still aiming for March or April time period, but they don't want to set people up for disappointment. So they're like, hey, we'll just say 2017, and then if it's still March, you know, if we're still able to hit that launch time frame, then hey, there's a good surprise. You know, hey, yeah, what's coming out in March?
If Breath of the Wild does not come out at the same time as NX and doesn't become like an NX launch title, the sheer disappointment that will flood the internet will just crush every single server out there. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine.
I think they basically, if they delay the NX to June or later or whatever, I think Zelda will be delayed as well. I think they're gonna make sure that that's a launch title.
Yeah, if the NX is delayed, then Zelda's delayed. It's terribly disappointing, but it's a little bit more understandable than if the NX releases in March, and then they're like, "Oh, I'm sorry, we're gonna delay Zelda for a few more months, or we're gonna wait till holiday 2017."
Yeah.
Like that just seems like, you know, PR suicide. But you know, before, like I said, we finally saw Breath of Wild for the first time, and it's a very, very back to its roots game, I would say. Like, that was my first impression when I first saw, like, the opening minutes, was this is Zelda going back to its roots, but with an obvious graphical upgrade. is you wake up in a chamber, which we'll go back, we'll come back to the chamber and the technology a little bit later. But, you know, you wake up into a chamber and you get your little tablet and, you go outside into like this vast open field and you like, you start out right before a cliff too. And like, you finally see this world for the first time, this, you know, what turns out to be a small section of this much, much larger world, you know, from what we saw in the map in the demo. But, you know, it's huge. And they say immediately, you can go anywhere. You know, you don't even have to, like, there's an old man that you see. You don't even have to follow that old man. You can jump off the cliff or, you know, climb down the cliff if you want to be safer about it. You know, and I think that's amazing.
Yeah. And I love how you mentioned it's going back to its roots. And, you know, for those that have played the original Zelda, which hopefully everyone has, but I'm sure we've got some younger listeners too that may not have.
Yeah, everybody on the KoopaCast has, right?
Say yeah, everyone here has, yeah.
Okay, because I was going to kick you out if you guys have not played it.
Yeah.
I'm going to kick you out, I'm going to stop the podcast, and we're not going to record until you finish the game.
That's right.
That includes you and the viewer. If you haven't played The Legend of Zelda, pause the podcast, go play it, and then come back, okay?
Ben.
Okay, are you back? Good. That game was awesome, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now you know where... Now you know where guys are coming from in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, the Breath of the Wild gameplay, you know, when you can, like, start things on fire and, like, you have the fire propagation and the wind and everything that affects it, you know, and then they're like, hey, this was just like the original Zelda game where you could burn down certain trees that, you know, would lead to certain dungeons or to, you know, secrets in the world. And I was like, you know what? That's true. They did have, you know, terrain as, you know, it's kind of like dynamic terrain, even if way back in the NES days, being able to destroy certain elements on the overworld and find these secret hidden pathways. I don't know. It was kind of cool just seeing a modern, you know, translation of that, of, hey, you're shooting this fireball that's going to start things on fire.
So is there going to be somebody that says, pay me for the door repair charge?
I hope so.
If we,
yeah.
I really do.
I saw some gameplay where Link is going into, it looked like someone's house, but there were like some items on like a table. And I was like, I wonder, you know, because they said they removed the NPCs in a lot of the towns for the E3 demo. I wonder if that is like a shop or something. And I wonder if you can actually, like, pick up the stuff and, like, run out, kind of like in past Zelda games, and I'm sure there'll be consequences for it. I think it'd be kind of funny if they included that.
And if I...
Have wanted posters up of you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And if I can just throw one more comment about the... If I could throw one more comment about, you know, the parallels to the original Legend of Zelda, they kind of pointed out in the treehouse that the opening cliff scene that you see when Link walks out of the Cave of Resurrection, and you kind of see that landscape before you, that landscape is actually like a recreation of this, you know, this picture that they had. I think it was, what, in the booklet, right? Of Link.
Yeah, in the game's manual.
Yeah, the game's manual of Link, you know, standing over the cliff and looking down on Hyrule.
Yeah, it kind of had sort of a sunset type colors in the background. Yeah, he's on this big precipice looking out. Yeah, they've beautifully recreated it in the new one.
And
yeah, that was amazing to see.
So, that old man, just one more thing about that old man. Like, we all think, like, I think that's the King of Hyrule. Is anybody else on that?
I could see that. We also, Katie and I had a theory that it might be Ganondorf, and that he's from the future, he's from the past. He's been living for this last 100 years, and he's kind of had some remorse, and he's trying to help you, you know, get rid of the calamity Ganon, which is no longer part of his person or
That sounds way too complicated and deep for any Legend of Zelda game.
It may be a little too deep. It was actually borrowed from a comic book storyline with Vandal Savage, who, if you know DC Comics, is this kind of immortal guy that's been since, like, caveman days. Anyways, he finally takes over the world, and he has remorse, and Superman goes into the future, and, you know, and Vandal Savage is like, hey, I'll help you. This was a terrible mistake. So he has all this remorse, ends up helping Superman fix the timeline and go back in the past and defeat him. Anyway, but it could be that could be way, way off base. And I kind of hope that it's kind of crazy.
I don't know, you could just be an old man. Throwing that
out
there.
Like in the original, it's like, it's dangerous to go alone and take this, you know? Yeah. Or let's play money-making game. The world was kind of populated with these old men that, you know, would just spout a line or two. So maybe there's a family of old wise men that populate Hyrule.
This one just seemed to be the one old wise man that, you know, kept coming back, that you kept giving the orbs to. And, like, he showed up in that paraglider after you left one of the shrines. So it's like, it's just this one old man. At least that's what it seems to me, is it's this one old man that we're seeing right now. He's kind of trying to guide you a little bit.
Yeah.
I think I had read that somebody was wondering if, like, it's the world from Wind Waker where the sea had resided and, you know, that's where the terrain of the land's like it is. So maybe it's the King of the Red Lions when there was no water. He turned from the boat.
Yeah, that's what made me think of it, because, like, you see his beard, the old man's beard, and it looks exactly like the King of Hyrule's beard in Wind Waker.
Yeah, it's true.
But when Link talked to him, did he go like, "Arr"?
Is that what
Yeah.
He got the really deep "Arr".
That's
pretty good, actually.
there's something else.
You know, boats, real quick, I wanted to point out that they actually, in a way, included the raft from the very first Zelda game.
Yeah.
There was a section where they had to cross, like, some icy water, and you had to use the Korok leaf to blow on the sails of the raft to get across the shore. I thought that was really neat that they brought that back.
Yeah, just another connection from the original. Cool.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm stuck on timelines now, because there is a timeline. So I think it's the timeline, like the Link Fails timeline, where it's like the original Legend of Zelda and, like, Link to the Past and all that. Like, yeah. I think it's that timeline, because that timeline was called the Decline of Hyrule, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if everything we're seeing for Hyrule here is, like, part of the decline, then, you know, We saw the Temple of Time, it's completely in ruins, and nobody's picked up the Master Sword in, like, what looks like centuries. And if you think about, like, you know, the first Legend of Zelda and then Link's Adventure, like, he never had the Master Sword there either, so obviously it was lost to time at that point.
But there was the Rusted Broadsword, or whatever it was called, I forget.
Yeah, the Rusted Broadsword that you picked up off in the middle of that little river lake thing.
Yeah. They're like, yeah, I'm going to grab the Master Sword 5 minutes in.
Yeah,
that would have been amazing.
Wouldn't it be cool if you could find, like, say, like, the White Sword or the Magical Sword from the first game?
I mean,
there as usable items.
Who's to say they're not there, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. That would be awesome.
Yeah,
there was so much they didn't. I mean, there were some people I know on, like, watching Twitter, they're like, oh, this game's not going to have any towns or NPCs. And it's like, guys, watch the Treehouse stuff. You know, they're deliberately not showing that because, you know, they don't want to have spoilers. And, so even though it seems like we saw a lot, in reality, we saw so little.
Yeah, that's true. I know, and a lot of people were jumping to the conclusion that there weren't going to be any large dungeons, you know, just going to be these, you know, shrines. And, you know, obviously, if you watch the Treehouse stuff, you'll know that there are going to be dungeons, and, you know, but they just didn't want to show those for, again, not to spoil any of those key points.
I feel like you would have known there were dungeons.
How cool the trials are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love the visuals.
Yeah, the visuals and the audio that the kind of the audio cues they use when all the monks speak. Like, I think that's really nice. That's really awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting about the monks. When I saw them for the first time, I instantly got an image of those Buddhist monks that would be in meditation for so long that their body would kind of like waste away and kind of mummify. And I almost feel like they kind of gave that design to the monks. I thought that was really cool.
Now, are you talking about the ones that like the monks were in the statues?
At the end of the trials, like the monks that would talk to you.
Yeah. But I'm talking about like in, you know, they're in real life where those, they put the monks in the statues and the, like they think that's the way the monks would preach.
They found Buddhist monks that have literally been in meditation so long that they've kind of mummified themselves. Like they'll be shut away in caves and stuff.
Yeah. No, these guys were like encased in statues and they put like a little, like poked a little air hole or a straw in there and they kept them alive just long enough to like, for like 3 days or something like that or 3 weeks. It was just, it was messed up.
Yeah. That was the kind of imagery that came to mind. So I'm thinking it's like, they said that they were blessed with the sight of Hylia, so I almost got the same imagery. Like, they went into meditation, like, waiting for, like, the hero to come back so they could guide him. They kind of wasted away to almost nothing while they were waiting. I'm creating lore in my head as I'm watching, like, all of this awesome footage. none of that's confirmed, but that's kind of, like, the backstory that I gave them, which is so much fun when you watch these gameplay videos with so little information. You know, you just want to make up your own lore for, like, why that's there.
Yeah. It definitely, the world does give the impression that it's been like this for a while. You know, these ruins, the maps are sort of mean. You know, it looks like it's more than 100 years old. And they said Link's been sleeping for 100 years, but the Master Sword looks definitely older than just 100 years.
Yeah, it looks like it's been sitting there for, like, yeah, X amount of, it's been there for 20XX years.
Yeah, so future after Wind Waker or something, maybe it's 1,000 years after, or, you know, several hundred.
And I wonder, I don't think it was explained, and I might be jumping, because I think Matt said he wanted to talk about it, but the chamber that you see Link in at the beginning, and the sort of, looks like a sensory deprivation bed he's laying in, that wasn't really... talked about at length, really. Was it what it was?
No, I don't remember hearing them actually mentioning kind of what that was.
Well, I was thinking because, at least from a visual sense, and they also did say that technology was going to come to the forefront in this Zelda adventure for like the first real time, you know. And I was thinking about it when Alex was talking, you know, what if Link or, you know, important characters were kind of put in, you know, hibernation, you know, in some kind of, you know, sci-fi pod or whatever.
Yeah, it's like cryogenics almost, not freezing him, but put him in some sort of suspended animation in there.
Yeah, that's what it kind of looked like when I was watching and the water's going down and Link's in there and I'm like, I wonder. And, you know, it would be different for Zelda, but certainly I think in harmony with, you know, adventure RPG spirit. You know.
Yeah, and you know, technology isn't necessarily, you know, something completely new to the Zelda series. I mean, even in Skyward Sword, do you remember that dungeon where you're manipulating certain, like, these time bubbles in the desert?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely, yeah. That was an awesome dungeon.
Yeah, there were, like, conveyor belts, and there was quite a bit of, you know, what we would consider technology, you know. But it's kind of based on... You know, it's like a different path, not quite computers or the technology we have. It's more,
it's like if they fused like technology with almost like ancient relics.
Yeah, like Atlantean, like, you know, Lost in Atlantis type technology.
Well, what I found interesting was the place that he wakes up in is called the Resurrection Chamber. Yeah. And I think the only thing that they acknowledged about that was Bill said something along the lines of, this is a very mysterious place that you've created, Mr. Onuma.
Yeah.
And so, like, they were kind of, like, getting you to think about it. And I almost wonder, like, what if in the story Link is actually dead and they've used that resurrection chamber to kind of
bring him back to life, in a way.
Yeah.
Didn't they already do a game theory video on that, that, like, Link was dead in Majora's Mask, or...
Yeah.
Or something. Totally,
but this would be, like, the third time...
I don't know if they'd want to go that route, but...
But they did go that route, because they confirmed that that Hero Shade was Link from Majora's Mask.
Well, it's interesting, too, like, with technology, depending on the culture that's presented in this Hyrule, you know, a lot of things that are technological or sci-fi can very well seem magical to them if they're from the future. I mean, if we went back in time and people saw us talking on our tablets across the world, you know, we'd be burned at the stake, you know, as being wizards or something. So I think there's some real potential to kind of to work that technology lore into the existing, Zelda staples.
Yeah.
And we've been going on lore for quite a while here, but we're also starting to run a little bit long here on the KoopaCast. So we're going to go ahead and move this train along here and talk a little bit about kind of the gameplay that we saw out there. You know, we saw that, you know, Link's not going to get a sword or, you know, at least what we know so far is he's not getting a sword. He's not getting, like, a bow and arrow. He's not getting, you know, this item that, you know, you pick up in a treasure chest. He's getting, like, a sword he found in the field or a tree branch or, you know, a bow and arrow said that he got from, like, raiding a bow goblin camp, you know? So that they're definitely going a completely different direction with these kinds of items that, you know, that Link finds and kind of picks up and uses in the field.
I think it'll be interesting because it seems like they took the mechanic from Wind Waker when you could steal an enemy's item and use it against them and took that much further to where you can carry it with you, which I always enjoyed that from Wind Waker, so I was pretty pleased to see that they took that like a step further. You know, you can find and collect these weapons that kind of suit your play style. When you saw, like, when they used the woodcutter's axe, it was a very slow but powerful weapon. Where, I say, if you found, like, a spear, I can't say that word, spear, but there we go. It was,
I was confused, I was like, there was a spear?
Yeah. And, it was much faster. So I think it'll be cool to experiment and, find which weapon suits me best.
And there's got to be a fishing rod weapon, right? At some point that you can.
Oh, absolutely.
I think they showed footage. I think they showed footage with Link with a fishing rod, right?
They kind of did a nod to A Link to the Past, where you can find broadswords stuck in pedestals, and it makes me think of the fake master swords in the Lost Woods in A Link to the Past.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was intentional.
This world and the gameplay, I think, are really suited for perishable weapons because you have a Link that can jump. Climbing really seems to be a strong emphasis. So if you find yourself in a situation where your weapons are weak or you just broke, your last weapon, you know, what's to stop Link from hopping away or climbing away? I think, you know, it definitely fits. You're not going to find yourself in scenarios where you're really up a creek if you're out of weapons. I think there's, for skilled players, they'll find a way to get around that and be able to replenish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think they really want to create scenarios where you feel like you're kind of in over your head, so you get that survival feeling that they're going for, which... to me, it's almost kind of like a first since the first Zelda game. Usually when I play a Zelda game, I always kind of feel like I'm in control.
Yeah, and you feel kind of overpowered at times, unless you're playing like a hero mode in Zelda games. When you get these big items, you're like, oh, I've got such a big advantage over, you know, the enemies, you know, even the bosses sometimes in the dungeon. This feels more like you're more vulnerable. And you're surviving, with limited resources.
And I know it's kind of, you know, maybe taboo to bring up non-Nintendo games and to a Nintendo podcast, but, you know, I definitely got like a, maybe well, one, there's obviously there's a Skyrim vibe to it, but also kind of a Far Cry 4 vibe, or yeah, Far Cry. That's what I'm thinking of, right?
Yeah, I can see a Far Cry vibe.
Yeah, Far Cry 4, where you know you're going through the jungle and you're kind of like you're doing hunting, but you're also kind of raiding these camps.
Yeah, well, four was based in the Himalayas, or well, a fictional Himalayan analog, but Far Cry 3 was the jungle one, and as well as the first one. The second one was based in Africa. What's interesting about, you know, you bring up Far Cry, the fire propagation that they have in this new Zelda,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a big staple that they added in Far Cry 2 and has been in the subsequent 3 and 4. But I think that's just a cool detail. You know, like you throw, you know, a burning stick in the grass, and it, well, it's going to start that on fire and start the tree on fire.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes the world more believable, more savage, you know, and more dangerous to Link. You know, Alex brought up that point of surviving in this world, and so, you know, the world is almost like this big character in the game, because it can be your friend, but it can also be your enemy, depending on, you know, whatever, you know, pitfalls it throws at you.
And that's a good point you brought up, Justin, about, or you, Justin, and you, Alex, both at the same time kind of brought this up. If you think about, and they brought this up in the Treehouse, when they talked about when they named this new Legend of Zelda, it's not named after a key item, it's not named after a companion, it's named after, you know, the world that Link is exploring. So in that way that you guys are talking about, you know, the world is this item, the world is, you know, this companion, this character, ever-present character in this Legend of Zelda game.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's an interesting concept. I mean, I guess you could say the same about a lot of other Zelda games too, that, you know, the world is, you know, somewhat of a character. You could probably personify some of Link's worlds that way, but this one just seems more so. Just the scope of the world, the depth of, you know, the gameplay, the variety of terrain and interactable objects, the fact you can climb everything is just, you know, a level of freedom we haven't had since that first Zelda. Well, and even since any Zelda game, because even in the first Zelda, you couldn't climb up, you know, obviously certain sections of mountains, or, you know, you were limited to certain areas where you could walk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this one is, I mean, basically anything you can see, you can climb it, you can get there. That's pretty cool.
The climbing definitely gave me Shadow of the Colossus vibes. It's interesting to traverse the environment in Shadow of the Colossus, because you can climb, and it kind of makes trekking through the world a little more dynamic, because the mountain isn't a barrier anymore. It's, okay, how do I get around this? You know, do I climb up it, or do I go around? It's not just there to stop you from progressing.
I think it'll be interesting to see, especially since the last Wii U Zelda game was Twilight Princess HD a couple months back. So, you know, within a year's time, you're going from the overworld of, like, you know, Twilight Princess, which was probably the most consistent area that was maybe criticized. It's this big world, but there's not a lot to do. And now you're going to Breath of the Wild, where it's this huge world, but, you know, there's seemingly, you know, the world's your oyster. You can do whatever you want. There's not going to be a lack of things to do if you just want to run around and slice grass or bomb moblins or climb trees or, you know, or whatever. I'll be interested to see how people react, you know, especially coming off, you know, of a game like that and moving on to this.
Someone was bringing up an interesting point too. I don't know if you guys heard that Nintendo had made some comment to the effect that you can kind of go sort of to the final boss. They kind of alluded that you could beat the game quicker. So you didn't necessarily need to beat all of the dungeons. If you found a way to beat the last boss, you could actually you know, make that your goal and do that very quickly versus going to every shrine or every dungeon in the game.
Yeah, I believe I heard the words straight to Ganon.
Yeah, straight to Ganon. So that brings up an interesting idea. Someone was talking about, we all remember Chrono Trigger, very well-known RPG from the Super Nintendo era.
I'm actually playing that right now.
Yeah.
I mean, during this podcast, like, I got bored with what you guys were saying.
Nice.
Well, with Chrono Trigger, you have several endings. I mean, you've got time travel, you've got interesting things that kind of lead to different endings in that game. But potentially, depending on how you progress through this new Zelda game, it might be interesting to see if you have, I don't know, different endings, or maybe characters that you would meet along the way don't necessarily factor in the end game if you just went straight to Ganon. So it'd be interesting how they tackle that. I don't know if that's necessarily going to be the case, but like, think of the replayability at that point. If you went through this Zelda game and you're talking to your friend, you're like, hey, I did these two dungeons up on the northwest rim of this area, and then I was able to get to Ganon, and I did this, and they're like, well, I went down to this southeast area, and I did four dungeons, and got this really cool armor, and, you know, and then fought Ganon, and there's this really cool end scene. Do you get this one, too? I don't know. That could be kind of a fun dynamic, but we'll see.
Yeah. That's a good point, because I remember, you know, back in the day, people could be like, oh, Chrono Trigger, I beat that in 15 hours. But, you know, if you are going for all the endings, you could sink 100 hours into that game. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give – I actually – we got a lot of comments on the potential to beat the game early. I think some are going to appear in the next issue, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But there was some real worry from people. And fear, but I think if we're being honest, you know, seeing like, you know, how the Treehouse staff are getting knocked around, you know, are you really going to run to Ganon with three hearts and beat him? I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. We're good gamers, but I think it's more of a situation. We're going to beat the game normally and then down the line. Okay. Now I know its ins and outs. I know its secrets. Let's see if I can do it for bragging rights.
Yeah,
because I can't imagine anybody wanting to try to do that or necessarily even be able to do it on their first run.
Right.
With a three-heart link.
Yeah, I almost see people doing it as more like a challenge, you know, like you said, on their third or fourth playthrough. Because even in current Zelda games, there are people that, you know how you get a heart container when you beat bosses normally? Mm-hmm. But they'll skip those, right? And they'll try and keep progressing through the game with just the three or four hearts or whatever they start with. So potentially you could have, you know, fourth or fifth playthrough, people trying to, you know, once they figure out where Ganon is with their first playthrough, you know, maybe his weaknesses or, you know, like, oh, well, if I get this item, you know, the first hour of gameplay, that I can make a beeline to him, and I can use some elixir that gives me some temporary hearts, and then maybe I have a, you know, just a really steep challenge, but it could be an interesting, you know, different playthrough than their first two or three times.
I don't know. I think I'll be disappointed in the speedrunning community if there isn't an any percent Naked Link speedrun. No armor, no nothing.
Yeah.
You can bet with Miiverse, people are going to be, and I'm assuming that NX is going to carry over Miiverse, I don't know, but you can bet there'll be people uploading their photos with their times for bragging rights.
Yeah,
definitely. All right. I am actually going to go ahead and wrap this up for real this time. Otherwise, you know, if we keep going the way we're going, this podcast is going to be over 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And I can't have that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and thank you, Alex, Justin, and Trevor for joining me on this segment.
It was fun.
Yeah, that's fun.
And for those of you listening at home, please stay tuned. We have a second segment coming up, where I talked to Trevor about a couple of the retro reviews he's done. So stay tuned for that. Hey everyone, welcome back to the KoopaCast. In this segment, I'm joined by writer Trevor Gould.
Hi everyone, thanks for listening.
And we're going to take a break from all this E3 talk, and we're going to go ahead and discuss a couple of Trevor's virtual console reviews, Yoshi's Story and Star Tropics 2. I wanted to go ahead and start with Star Tropics 2, which was released in 1994 for the NES. And it was also released on the Virtual Console on March 24th. At least that's what I read.
Actually, I think Star Tropics 2 is a more recent one. I think Yoshi was the March 24th.
Oh, you're right, you're right. Yoshi's Story was March 24th. I'm getting my notes mixed up already. This is a great start for the first episode of the fourth season.
I'm happy to talk about either, or both.
Yeah, Star Tropics 2, was released for the Virtual Console on May 26th. So none of these are actually recent releases, at least recent in comparison to this recording. So what made you decide to just kind of do this, to review these games?
Well, I had both downloaded on the original Wii Virtual Console, and, you know, I like to win. A game gets moved to the Wii U to transfer it for, you know, just $1 or maybe $2 in the case of N64 games. I don't remember exactly, but it's a small price to have, you know, the option of restore points, of, you know, Miiverse, soft TV play, things like that. So both of these games I had just waiting for when they got a release, and especially in the case of Zoda's Revenge, Star Tropics 2, it really benefits from having restore points.
You used a lot of restore points. That's what I'm getting from this.
I don't know if I use a lot, but I definitely know when to use them. The game has a decent save system in place anyway. It was a battery backup, you know, game back in the day, and it saves between dungeons, between chapters. So it's not a bad save system anyway. But the design of it is such where there's definitely certain rooms, especially if you know what's coming ahead. I'm like, I'm going to hit a restore point here because the game, in a lot of ways, can be very cheap. I'll just give you a quick example. Like in most games, and including the original Star Tropics, if an enemy hits you, you know, you'd have that brief second of invulnerability where you can, you know, sort of escape, get out of the way, regroup. But in Zoda's Revenge, you get hit. There's really no recovery time. So depending on the layout, if one enemy hits you, it can be, you know, an all but certain death because you simply won't have time. The controls aren't quick enough to get out of there before 5, 6, 7 hits register. So it's that sort of thing that can really frustrate, and that's where I think restore points can come in handy.
So what are they called? Like invincibility frames. It's either invincibility or invulnerability.
Not really. Not to the discernible eye, anyway. And the room can be packed with enemies. Depending on you take a wrong turn or you jump into a room you're not familiar with, you know, you get hit once. That could very well be it. And it's a little atypical from, you know, even for NES hard games, most of them that I'm familiar with, you know, that's sort of a given. You know, there's difficulty and then there's being cheap. And I think Star Tropics takes a step backwards in that sense because it's really cheap. Because I like to always feel when I fail that, okay, you know, it's my own fault. If I do this differently, I'll succeed. But there's sometimes in Zoda's Revenge, Star Tropics 2, where because of the lack of that, it just goes beyond a fun challenge and just gets, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. So it's an acquired taste, but I think, you know, in a sense, it is better on the Wii U because it has restore points, which you can use for certain, you know, certain times. It's got a decent save system, like I said already. But I use them when I think I'm going to need them. And it saves having to replay chunks of dungeons that you've already conquered.
All right. We kind of got a little bit into the restore points, and I actually wanted to start out by asking you about the plot of the story, so let's go ahead and do that now. What is the plot? Like, I did a little research, and it looks like you're time traveling this time?
It's not a bad story. The first Star Tropics pretty much kept you, regionalized to a layout of islands, which had a nice, happy kind of continuity. But Star Tropics 2 takes you through various times. I think you start in the Ice Age, you go to the Old West, you go to Victorian London, you go to Camelot. So it gives you an opportunity to interact with some historical figures, real figures, fictional figures, which is nice. I don't necessarily think it has the charm per se of the original story, but I think it was a good direction. I tend to like science fiction, time travel, and it definitely lends itself to a bit more variety in some respects.
Well, I mean, it's pretty good. I've never played the first one. I've never played the second one. But it definitely seems like, the logical progression from space is time. So, and I mean, where do you go from that? That's why there's no Star Tropics 3, right?
I wish there was a Star Tropics 3. I think as much as I appreciate Nintendo supporting the NES so late in its life, I think it sort of hurt this game because, in 94, the Super Nintendo was kind of in its prime. You got, your Super Metroid games like that coming out, and, the NES was very, the technology was primitive by that point in time. And they advertised, it wasn't a lack of advertisement. I remember even as a kid seeing the top loader NES advertising Star Tropics 2 along with Mega Man 6. But unlike, Mega Man, which had five games prior, it had that lineage. Star Tropics really only had the first game, and there was such a long gap between them, as well as changes in the way the game controlled and whatnot. I think it maybe lost some fans, whether due to that, whether it was due to the timing with the SNES, and I think it's unfair to blame the weaker sales, because of that. Timing is everything, and we're seeing that now as we're on the cusp of, the NX will be out before we know it. How are these, late Wii U games gonna sell when people know the NX is out? But I definitely think the series has potential to be revived. I know there was a rumor some years ago about, I think it was Camelot working on it, but they never came to fruition. I think there's potential for a third. I think there's potential to do an HD version of the first two, sort of like what Capcom did with DuckTales. I'd like to see even in Smash Brothers. I think Mike deserves a cameo of some type. They're tapped into so many other obscure series.
I was thrown for a loop for a second when you said HD remake of the first two Star Tropics. I'm thinking, how are you going to do that? And then you mentioned DuckTales when, I think, what was it? Wait, Way Forward to the, the animation kind of, really helped out with that?
Yeah, and that was, and the great thing about that was so, true to the original. So even though it looked brand new and had, some changes out of necessity, by and large, it played the same, I remember if I jump here, a diamond's going to be here. And sure enough, it was. I think Star Tropics could benefit from that if it was in the right hands. Certainly, I think Way Forward would be great for that. I don't know if, what Nintendo has in terms of, now that they're more familiar with HD development, if they have teams that would tackle something like that. But, hopefully, if the Virtual Console releases, sell well, they'll at least let them take note. I think Star Tropics has a vocal fan base, even if it's smaller than some of the other Nintendo hits. And I think the gameplay holds up, pretty well. There's a lot of Zelda influence in it. And they're just fun, and they're tough. You know, people who complain about casual games, they're looking for a challenge. You know, play Star Tropics or Star Tropics 2, and you'll see. You know, when they talk about NES hard games, these are, you know, a couple of the poster childs for that, I think.
All right. And what did you give Star Tropics 2?
Star Tropics 2, I gave a 7, which is good. You know, I've always been a, you know, believer in using the full 10-point scale, where 5 is average, so 7 is good. It's well above average, I think. You know, the big, it's hard not to compare it to the original, especially, you know, when it's pretty much a direct sequel. It picks up not long after the first. I thought, for being such a late release, you know, the graphics were, you know, could have been better. I thought the soundtrack was fairly weak. A lot of these things are, of course, you know, subjective, depending on how much you played and loved the original like I did. But certainly some of the cheaper aspects, the lack of any recovery time from a hit, or and a bit of a spoiler alert, I guess I'll just say the ending, you know, as a design that can definitely make you want to tug your hair out. I don't necessarily think it's strong. So things like that made me knock it down, but it's certainly, you know, still a good game, still a game I recommend, but I wouldn't recommend it over the first. The first is one of my favorite games for the NES. I definitely think you should play them in order, you know, in order not to have the second have be full of spoilers, because it's pretty much a direct follow-up.
All right. And let's go ahead and move on from Star Tropics 2 to, you know, a little bit forward in time, to Yoshi's Story, which was released in 1997 for the N64, and then, of course, it was released on March 24th for the Virtual Console. So, why Yoshi's Story? I mean, I've already got my own opinions on Yoshi's Story, but I want to hear yours first.
Why did I review it?
Why did you decide to review Yoshi's Story here?
Well, usually, if a game is coming out on either the Wii U or 3DS Virtual Console, not so much the 3DS, Nintendo hasn't really done much with that in recent months, but usually if a game's coming out on the Wii U Virtual Console, and it's a game I have, I'll usually consider reviewing it, just because I like to see, you know, pure Nintendo do more with Virtual Console coverage. And not every game that comes out, I don't always get around to it, but in the case of Yoshi's Story, it was one of those games on my list, and I got it up a little later than I planned to, but I reviewed Yoshi's Island for the Virtual Console, the Game Boy Advance version, and of course I reviewed Woolly World last year, so I figured why not get Yoshi's Story up, and then you can sort of have my opinion across the three, you know, big games.
So far, you've got the monopoly on all the Yoshi games.
Well, the console ones. Alex did Yoshi's New Island for the 3DS, and I'm not sure if we've covered any of the handheld ones off the top of my head. Definitely for the big console ones, I've got the three up, I guess.
We'll get you to review. What is it? It's Yoshi's... I mean, not New Island. Yoshi's Island DS?
I'm sorry? What was the question?
Yoshi's Island DS. I think that's the one we're going to get you on next.
Oh. Yeah, perhaps. You know, there's definitely a lot of, you know, other games and spin-offs and whatnot. There's Yoshi's Touch and Go, and I think even the Super Nintendo had a sort of a first-person Yoshi shooter with the Super Scope. So, I mean, there's plenty of...
I've got that game, Yoshi Safari.
there's plenty still to cover.
Yeah, I've got to get the Super Scope. I got to, go online. Maybe I'll buy a Super Scope. And then I'll go review Yoshi Safari, because I've got the cartridge with me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I'll admit, though, I think I barely ever played it. I don't remember it being that remarkable.
I don't know. I've never played it either, so I don't know. I just remember seeing screens of it back in the day, and I'm like, oh, wow, this is interesting.
It's like, yeah. I think it was Nintendo's, I don't know. Do you think it was like Nintendo's answer to like Doom and Duke Nukem and all that? They're like, well, they got that. We got Yoshi. What can we do with that? But enough about Yoshi. Let's talk about Yoshi. You did Yoshi's Story. I certainly think it was definitely one of the weaker of the Yoshi games out there. And I feel like I feel like we've come across this opinion before. I feel like we've butted heads on this, but I'm glad we got audio for it now. Because you are, I'm not going to reveal the score right now, but it looked like you were actually a real fan of Yoshi's Story, right?
You don't think I was what? I'm sorry?
No, I thought you're a fan of Yoshi's Story, right? Like, that's what I gathered from your review score.
I absolutely am a fan of Yoshi's Story. And I think that's what's nice now that I've done review of the three big console adventures. You can kind of, by looking at them all, you can kind of gauge my feelings of them all. I think they're all very good games in their own ways. But I definitely, I suppose, compared to a good number of critics, I've got some differences in terms of how I view Yoshi's Story.
Like which one of the, which one of the big reasons that you gave or where you scored? Let me try that again. So, what are the, man, I'm just like, the longer we go on there, the worse my speaking becomes.
That's okay. I'll try to pick up the slack.
Thanks. That's what I've been relying on you this entire time for. It's like, I wish you could talk more so I could talk less.
I'll interview myself. So, Trevor, why are you such a brilliant reviewer? Well, that's a great question. I think it's, I'm just playing.
No, that's going to be the end. I didn't think about it before, but we're going to put stingers in all our podcast episodes, and that's going to be one right there. But what I wanted to ask is, like, what's one of the reasons why you kind of scored Yoshi's Story so high?
Well, I debated it. I almost did score it a smidge lower, but I've always been a big believer in considering a game's enjoyment in relation to the game's cost. I know certain reviewers or critics, they disregard that. They say, a game is good or bad regardless. And I certainly hear that point of view, but, there's a reason why we might, play Angry Birds for 50 cents and think it's fun on our phone, but not spend $60 and think it's good on the Wii U. There's cost involved. When I look at Yoshi's Story now available for $10, I personally think that's a steal. And I mentioned this in the review. It was a good seller. It was a player's choice. But even back in the day, because it was cartridge, the player's choice games for the 64 were still $40, which is definitely better than $70. But that was still a lot of money. And, for the content and length, did it correlate with $40? Maybe not. Probably not for the typical player. But now that it's on Wii U and you can get it for $10, I think it's well worth it. And I think visually too, I think it's aged terrific compared to so many 64 games, because it didn't have that 3D world. It was a 2D or 2.5D. So I just think it's aged well, and I think the cost is great. So I took those things into consideration when I scored it, what I did.
All right. It definitely looks like it's aged pretty well. I don't think I've plugged that game in quite a while, but I certainly played the crap out of it when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember loving it then, but, as I got older, I kind of thought about it and I go, well, I think it was a little. I think it moved at a lot slower pace than Yoshi's Island.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I think that pace is really what really helps me dig Yoshi's Island or Super Mario World 2. Yoshi's Island is just like you know, you can go with this, like, great, you can take it slow, but you can also go with this, like, this, you know, fast pace and, like, you know, barely jump over enemies and, you know, do all these close calls and, you know. I think it was just kind of fun. And the music was fun and dynamic. And then when we go over to Yoshi's Story, it's like things are kind of moving a little bit slower. The music's a lot more relaxing, like, to the point where I just feel like I'm going to fall asleep. And Yoshi's, I mean, I don't have Yoshi's New Island, but all the music I've heard from it, it's, for me, like, that's what I didn't dig about that, is it just gave me flashbacks to that really just laid back and just falling asleep in a hammock music of Yoshi's Story.
Yeah, there's definitely similarities between the two, you know, in terms of, rather than having, like, totally brand new scores for, you know, each level or world, it's really more remixes of the main tune. And, of course, too, the music is tied into your health. So, you know, if you're full health, it's going to be more bouncy. If your health is lower, it's going to be slower. But, yeah, I can definitely understand how, you know, how it's not everyone's. But personally, I actually prefer more diversity, like from Yoshi's Island or Woolly World, for that matter. But it doesn't make me dislike Yoshi's Story. I think it's a good fit to the types of environments and the gameplay design that they were going for.
And Yoshi's Story is very... It can be very short. I mean, it's not. It doesn't have to be short, but it can be very short, right?
That's true. You know, and I suppose to some extent that argument could be put towards most Yoshi's game, but Yoshi's Story in particular, you know, it's basically, even though there's, you know, a couple dozen levels, you can only do play for six at a time, and then the game ends. It's designed, you know, as you unlock new levels, to do more playthroughs, do different runs, discover the new areas. But, yeah, six levels does not take long to beat through. And if you're not particular about the fruit you collect, it's even shorter. And that's why, you know, that's one of the reasons I think it's a better deal now than it was back in, you know, the late 90s, because, it's just, it doesn't have the content compared to its predecessor, I think, to justify, you know, $70 or even maybe $40, unless you're a real completionist.
Or just
that's definitely one of its weaker aspects.
All right, and let's go back to see, like, give me another strong aspect of Yoshi's Story.
Well, for me, I kind of look at Yoshi's Story almost like an arcade game. Because I think the scoring system is such a, I guess, underrated aspect of it. And I realize not everybody's into playing games for score. I probably, you know, probably reveals type of games I grew up with, where, you know, score was what you played for, whether it was like early NES cards or, you know, arcades, back when arcades were in their heyday. And in Yoshi's Story, the scoring system is so unique, you know, depending on which fruits you collect, the order you collect them in, which enemies you defeat or bypass, the order. There's a lot of depth there if you're willing to explore and discover. And the game has local, you know, local leaderboards, so you can chart, you know, can I beat this score? And of course now with Miiverse functionality, you can, if you're into that, you can share your scores on Miiverse, see how others do. I think in a sense that gives the game, if you're into scores, it gives the game almost limitless replay value. But I think that probably is somewhat divisive, because I know a lot of gamers who just, you know, can care less about points. And, you know, points don't work for every game. I mean, Zoda's Revenge, Star Tropics 2, they had a scoring system that, you know, means nothing to me. I don't even really know how it works. That's not a game that fits for scores. But Yoshi's Island, I think, is a good game for scoring. And I know a lot of older school gamers who can really, you know, get enthusiastic about that. And they love trying to, improve their score. So depends on if it's your cup of tea or not.
I feel like the best, or one of the best games I've seen to use the scoring system was Super Paper Mario on the Wii, because that scoring system was pretty much your like EXP system. You know, where you jumped on an enemy, you got 200 points. But if you got 70 points, then, you know, you got a little bit stronger and you could do more damage. And I feel like that really, like, I mean, obviously it's not points like most people would think points, but I thought it was definitely interesting and, you know, something I'd like to see, you know, other games, like, give a more unique way to use points in the game instead of just saying, hey, I got the highest score.
Yeah, I hear that. I think it's just, it's important to make the score mean something and have value to you. And that's why, like, in a lot of ways, I'm critical for, like, indie developers that are driven for, like, these retro arcade experiences. It irks me to see, like, them do a twist on the popular arcade game and not even let me enter my initials. It's like, you know, if you're trying to tap the arcade spirit, let's remember what a staple of the arcades was. So, yeah, I think it's important that scores have, you know, have meaning. And, you know, obviously it varies by individual.
Yeah. I'm not afraid to admit, I grew up probably just missing out on your generation in terms of what a score means. Because there were certainly plenty of arcade games in my day, but I mean, for us, it was just completing the game. Like, that was the goal. Like, that was the goal of, you know, putting in all the quarters for Time Crisis, the Time Crisis machines, or even that Jurassic Park one. I don't know if anybody ever remembers that.
Oh, I love that game. The sit-down one?
Yeah, the sit-down one where you're in the little Jeep.
Oh, yeah, that's a great game.
Yeah, like, but games like that, like, that was never, it was never about score for us. It was always just get as far as you can.
Yeah.
And then hopefully you didn't run out of money or your parents stopped giving you money.
Yeah, and that's why I think, like, with Yoshi's Story, the value is more subjective when compared to, like, Yoshi's Island or Yoshi's Woolly World, because, you know, if your goal is just to run through it, or even just to see every level, it's going to be a quick experience. So you need to ask yourself, you know, well, first of all, do you enjoy playing for high scores? And secondly, do you enjoy the level designs enough where replaying them is still fun? Because, you know, even though I like high scores, I'm not going to replay a game solely for a score if I don't think the core game is fun to begin with. You know, I have a lot of games that have leaderboards, but they just don't keep me engaged enough where I want to strive for that. I think Yoshi's Story, even though I don't like the shorter length, that's one of the benefits of it, is that it ties in well with the scoring system.
All right. And we're coming up to the end of the segment, so I'm going to go ahead and start wrapping this up here. Trev, I want you to thank you. Let me try wrapping that up again. Trev, I want to thank you for joining me on this episode, or on this segment of this episode.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here and talk retro gaming. It's always something I enjoy.
And as always, I'd also like to thank our listeners for tuning into the KoopaCast this week. So that was completely rude of me. I forgot to ask you, Trevor, what did you end up scoring Yoshi's Story?
I ended up scoring it on the higher end. I gave it an 8.5. I almost gave it an 8, and then I decided to err on the side of fun. I guess the score is higher than what you'll see, you know, compared to most others. But I will say, for what it's worth, Yoshi's Story is not driven by nostalgia for me, because I actually did not play it during the Nintendo 64's life. I first played it when it came out on the original Wii Virtual Console. So I don't think my views of it are clouded by, you know, memories from when I was a teenager or whatever. And I'm just tossing that out there because a lot of times with retro games, they are. Like the first Star Tropics, there's a lot of nostalgia there for me. with that game, Yoshi's Story, there's none, even though I remember it, you know, seeing screenshots and whatnot of it. My play with it is more in more recent times.
So there you go, guys. Yoshi's Story is not biased at all, but Star Tropics is absolutely biased.
Well, the original Star Tropics was, but I didn't end up reviewing that, so. Tristan ended up reviewing that, and I tried to get him to up the score, but he stuck to his guns. So.
That's right, on issue 18, I believe, is where people can find that review.
Yes, or 16, maybe? I can't remember exactly. You might be right.
Well, we'll correct it on here. I'll, like, lay audio over it. Like, issue number 16. Issue number 18. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and start wrapping this up here as we approach the end of the segment. So, Trev, I want to thank you for joining me for this segment here.
Oh, yeah, you bet. It was fun.
I'd also like to thank our listeners for tuning into the KoopaCast this week. If you have a question for the KoopaCast, you can always email us at podcast@purenintendo.com. That's podcast@purenintendo.com. You can also talk to us on Twitter. I am @purely_Matt. Trevor is @purely_G1. And all of us together...
I'm not purely underscore.
It's right in front of me, and I still said purely. Trevor is @TrevG1. There we go.
Underscore.
What did I say?
It's TrevG1.
So, that's Trev-G1. And all of us together...
Underscore, not hyphen.
And all of us together are @PureNintendo. So, if you want to hear more of the KoopaCast, you can always check out purenintendo.com and click on the KoopaCast section. You can also go to iTunes and look up KoopaCast. Anyway, for those who are looking at the RSS feed, it is purenintendo.com/feed/podcast. And finally, for more news, reviews, and features, please check out purenintendo.com, your independent source for all things Nintendo. All right, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye, everyone.